You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 105. Very exciting. I'm Jessica Quinto, and I'm your host. And today we are talking about rejuvenating native languages. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch, or Ute Peoples Treaty Lands, the Dene Ta, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. Today we have Dr. Neaachit Graymorning on the show. Dr. Graymorning holds positions in anthropology and Native American studies. He is a political anthropologist who has conducted research among Indigenous peoples of Australia, Canada, Colombia, New Zealand, East Timor, and the United States. Professor Graymorning's research includes Native American language maintenance and restoration, Indigenous sovereignty issues, and contemporary Native American issues. So welcome to the show, Dr. Graymorning. Very excited to have you.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be on the show.
Yes. Always exciting to get more language conversations on here. It tends to be a little archaeology heavy or cultural anthropology heavy. So always a very important topic that I wish we got to more on language rejuvenation. So very excited to have you. And to get us started, could you talk a little bit about what got you interested in this type of work?
Well, that's a bit of a story, but the short is I was asked to fill in for a Kiowa man, Gus Palmer, for the University of Oklahoma, the American Indian Institute at the University of Oklahoma. And at the time, I was living on the reservation in Wyoming, the Wind River Reservation, and we met when I was in grad school at University of Oklahoma. And the Institute asked if I would fill in for him.
Okay. All right. Perfect. So you filled in for him. And then where did you go from there?
Well, I guess the question is, what got me interested in this kind of work? And the answer to that is a hummingbird. And that is a very interesting story. Mm-hmm. When I was an undergraduate, there was a student takeover, student unrest. And when the dust settled from all of that, it was in April, around the third week of April, if I remember right, a very warm day, about 78 degrees. And the head of student organizations, various student organizations, were addressing the student body. We were all sitting out on the green. And at the time, somebody from the Black American or African American organization was talking. I was laying back on my elbows, and all of a sudden there was a voice over my left shoulder. And they were standing, behind them was the sun, and it obscured my ability to see the person's face. So I couldn't identify the person, but they said one thing. What are you doing for your people? I kind of looked down thinking, huh. When I looked up again, the person was gone. And I got up thinking I might find the person and walked away from the rest of the students and people that were sitting on the lawn and just kind of was walking going, where did that person go? And I got to the side of a building. At the time, I was wearing this medallion that was gifted to me by a Mohawk person. And it was made out of two hummingbird pelts. When I stopped at the side of the building, a hummingbird flew to the medallion and hovered there. And I kind of took a step forward. I went, oh, wow, little cousin. Took a step forward and the hummingbird moved back a little bit. And I stepped back and it moved forward a little bit. And then it turned and went around the corner of the building. I walked around the corner to see where it went, and it was hovering at the glass panes in a door, and the building was a library. And I thought, I wonder if I'm supposed to go inside. So I went there. The bird flew away. I went inside the building. Nobody was there because of the student unrest, and just started walking through the stacks of books, running my hand over the stacks of the books. And I stopped, not knowing why. And my hand was on a book. I pulled it down from the shelf, and the book, the subject material of the book, was about native languages and their state of health in North America.
Wow.
And I thought, I wonder how Arapaho's doing. So I looked to the index and saw that Arapaho is listed in the basically as one of the top 20 expected to continue into the next century. And I thought, okay, everything must be fine. Mm-hmm. But that stayed with me. And I asked an elder about it. And that led into a different kind of story that he told me about when he was young and how people would want to hear stories, and they would go to a storyteller, and this person, everyone would meet at a certain designated time in the evening, and he'd tell a story. And the stories would go in late into the night, and there would be a lot of children there. And when it got dark, the storyteller would call out the name of a child, and the child was expected to respond. And because other kids wanted to hear the story, if the child was snoozing, they would elbow the child and he would wake up. But if that didn't happen, the storyteller would say that everyone must be tired and it's probably time to end and go home. And to that, the elder said, when that happened to me, the elders had called your name. So that's what got me started. When I went to graduate school, I took every linguistic course that was available to find out what to do.
Wait, the storyteller had called your name or the elder's name?
The elders had called my name.
Oh, and you didn't remember this or know it at the time?
When the hummingbird came to me, it was the elder calling my name.
Oh, okay.
Either that or when the person stood over me and said, what are you doing for your people? I don't know. I never asked. It was one of those two, either the person or the hummingbird, or possibly both.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. So you knew then that you wanted to work on language rejuvenation. How did you go about doing that?
Well, we have a ceremony in the summer, and I would go into the ceremony. I'd gone into the ceremony a number of times, and each time I would bring in prayers about the language, because at that time, the elders knew that the language was faltering. At that time, there weren't any speakers above the age of, I think, the youngest speaker, sorry, was in their 50s. There weren't any speakers below the age of 50. So there was concern. So there were prayers about the language. And on one of those summers when I was in the lodge, it's a lodge where you fast, complete fast, no water, no food for 3 days.
Wow.
And there are two lodges. One is Naka'au, which is the rabbit lodge, and another is Hasa'au, which is it literally translates as throwaway lodge. And that particular year, I did them back to back. So I was without food and water for 6 days.
Wow.
And on the third day, I went on a journey. And that put me on a path to how to seek answers to what to deal with the problem or solutions to the problem. And yeah, that got me started on what eventually became the method that was developed for accelerated second language acquisition.
So, okay, I want to come back to the method here in a bit, but I'm just curious. So did you grow up hearing the language?
I would spend my summers with my grandparents, and my one of my grandparents was a first language speaker. So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And then did you start to learn it at that point, or did that come later?
Well, you always hear language, but because of the boarding school period era, grandparents went through that, they were very protective of the grandchildren, and you would hear across many different native languages that they did not want children to go through what they went through. There was a lot of trauma, and they didn't, I guess there was a concern that because children were punished for speaking the language, that if the grandchildren were exposed or children were exposed to the language, they would be taken away and undergo the same kind of problems, which really wasn't the case, but that trauma was still there.
Yeah.
So you would hear things quietly spoken between speakers, but it often was that situation where children weren't around when a lot of elders were speaking with each other in language, but I was always curious. Later, one of the things I remember, though, when I would ask my grandmother when I was older to speak to me, it always happened in the kitchen when all the lights in the house were turned off, and there was always just one light over the table, and we were sitting at the table, and she would always speak in whispers. That's what I always remember.
Yeah. So learning it or hearing it, you know, here and there as a child, but not in, you know, a teaching sort of way, since they were trying to protect the children. Do you feel like you got a sense for the different like sounds of the language at that young age? Or again, was that something that came later?
Like, no. You would hear you would get the sounds of the language. During that period of time, people would hear language spoken when there were gatherings and elders would pray at the gathering to start things off. Mm-hmm. The generation that I grew up in, and it still continues today, language most frequently happened at events like meetings or funerals. Mm. And so often the language was connected to funerals or times of crisis, suicides or deaths on the reservation. That's when you heard the language the most. It was rare that, and also at powwows, you would hear things. But then during the summer, when there's a summer ceremony, you would hear a lot of language then. But it was always disconnected from the reality of a child who's playing with other children, and you'd hear it in the background. So yes, you would hear the sounds of the language, but there wouldn't be any understanding to it. You would just hear the sounds.
Right, right. I mean, a lot like Hebrew for us, right?
The one thing that did carry over, though, is even though in a community where you're hearing, where people are hearing, children are hearing, or a household, let's put it that way, where children might hear the language in the household, because the parents are second language speakers of English, they have an accent with English. And so children were growing up with an accent as if English was their second language, which helped them when they spoke their heritage language.
That makes sense. All right. Well, we are already at our first break point, but when we come back, I really want to hear more about the method that you then went on to develop based on all of this experience. So we will be right back here in a second. Okay. So first of all, we just had a really interesting conversation off air about some of the different ways that like people hearing their parents speak sounding like second language learners, it helps them with their heritage language. Sorry, that wasn't on air. You'll just have to take, you know, one of Dr. Gray Morning's classes or something. It was fascinating, though. Anyways, so moving from there, I do want to ask you, you mentioned how all of those experiences started to kind of marinate into developing the method for language rejuvenation. So could you talk a little bit about how that process went for you?
So I knew that immersion was something that worked, but trying to get my years straight now. In 1992, the Hawaiians who had been working with immersion classes for some years now, they ran, I think it was over a week long, it might have been a 10-day, it wasn't a workshop, but basically they opened up their doors to the world. And I was living on the reservation. I got permission. That was a different story, but I got permission to, well, it's actually worth mentioning. The superintendent of the school board, of the school district, was non-native on the reservation. And I wanted to go to this conference, and he blocked, he didn't submit my application or request to the school board. And I found out about it, and I went to his office and questioned him about it, and he basically started, literally was yelling at me as if I was a middle schooler. And I calmly said, when he, I thought he was gonna, he was all red in the face and everything, and I, when he came up for air, I looked at him and I very calmly said, the last time I looked around the school district, there was only one person in it with a doctoral with a doctoral degree, and it's not you. So I got the school board to look at the application. He put it last on the agenda, thinking that we'd run out of time. And
wow,
my direct supervisor was very scared, asked for somebody to ask to go to Hawaii. And I approached the table because two of the people on the table were also ceremonial people. And I addressed them and I said, you know me. We've been in that lodge together, and you know that I'm doing this for the language. And Hubert Friday, who was one of those people, he looked at me and he said, and I said, I'm not going there to play. I'm not going there for a vacation. And it was all quiet. And he said, I believe you. And they unanimously allowed me to go. And so I went there, and what I realized was their success, but we didn't have those same kinds of situations. One, Hawaii has one language. There might be slight variations in dialect, but it's one language. And mm-hmm. on the continental United States, there's over
a couple.
And so we weren't in that same situation. So the problem was, how do we accomplish what the Hawaiians did when we have limited resources, limited time, and those were the two big and limited skills as far as teaching skills? And that was a question that would follow me for years.
Could you explain what the Hawaiian program was, just so our listeners can have that background?
I'm trying to remember what conference was called. I think it was a Nali conference. And I don't think Nali exists anymore. So I think it was Native American, Indigenous, or North American, probably Native American, Indigenous Languages. And there was something, Institute, that's what it was. So it was and they were part of the group. That was the group that I think primarily funded this. And the Hawaiians had been doing immersion for a number of years at that point. I think they had children that had gone from preschool all the way up to grade four. Because I remember I interviewed a number of kids. No, even beyond that, because I remember I had interviewed some of the kids who were 12 and 13. So they had been doing it for at least 6 years, I guess. That was the lead group. So the Hawaiians showed throughout these 1.5 week, I believe it was, the things that they did. People there got to see their classes from preschool all the way up to grade five. They also were running Hawaiian adult classes, which I sat in on. And it was very interesting because the teacher that was teaching the Hawaiian adult class was about, I think she was 21 years old or 22 years old. She was only in her third year of their college or university language program, Hawaiian language program. But she was able to run 3-hour classes for a whole semester. And when I sat in on the classes, they were all in the language. She rarely came out of the Hawaiian language. That's how strong their program was or is. So I got to see that. But again, the question was, how can this be replicated when we don't have the kind of money they have, when we don't have the time that we have, and there are all these different languages, we don't have the resources. And so I started working at that. There were two, I guess you call them aha moments. I was through my graduate program. I had a doctoral degree. I had moved off the Wind River Reservation because I was interviewed for a job at the University of Montana. So that's where I was at the time. So I was traveling a lot. And when I would go to airports, I would invariably find parents who had children whose language hadn't erupted yet. And I would listen to how they spoke to their children. Mm-hmm. And that cued me in one particular way. And so I started developing this method. And there's a lot of scientific elements to this that I rarely talk about, or I don't talk about that often, but it has to do how the mind develops. Children younger than the age of 5, the brain isn't lateralized, and so they're using whole brain, but they don't subvoice. Subvoicing happens after the brain lateralizes. That's when you are thinking, you hear a voice in your head. It's called subvoicing. And it happens in every language to my knowledge, it happens in every language. So the question was, well, if children aren't speaking in their head when they're 4 years old or younger, how are they thinking? And my daughter was around 2.5 years old or 3 years old, and we were on the reservation and we were watching Fantasia. And it was at night on Bald Mountain, and these spirits are coming out of the mountain and everything. And my daughter was looking really intense and whatever. And I asked her, what are you doing? And she said, I'm really thinking about this, what she was watching. And I asked her, when you think, do you hear words in your head or do you see things? And she said, I see things. Huh. So that kind of reinforced what was going on. And that led me to realize there was the big aha moment, but I'll say that in a minute. But that led me to realize that, well, I think it was in the lodge, actually, when I was in the ceremony. And I kept hearing in my head, a picture paints 1,000 words. You know, that's Confucius. And it kept coming back and back. And another thing out of a verse out of the Bible, child is a father to man. These things just kept coming at me. And that led me to develop the method along lines of visualizing language rather than memorizing language. The big aha moment was when I realized, and this was years into working, developing this and my traveling, and I think 4 years in or 6 years in, I realized that parents will tell children to do things before children actually are speakers of the language. A child is toddling along and a parent will ask the child, let's say a mother, oh, get mommy's glasses off the table. And the child will toddle over and they'll fumble around and they might pick up something and the parent goes, no, that's one of the first things that children learn, yes and no. And then they'll fumble around and they'll grab something else and they hear yes, and then they'll toddle over with the glasses. Mm-hmm. So the key that I realized was that cognition precedes speech language production. Mm-hmm. And so the method that I developed rests on being able to hear and understand what you're hearing first. Whereas everything else that people do, they try to memorize conjugation charts and memorize long or complicated sentences and such. And that's why it keeps failing, unless you have a great memory.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how do you then take that realization and turn it into like a classroom setting?
Well, because I teach through visualizing the language.
Mm-hmm. How do you do that, though?
Through imagery.
Okay.
That's how it's done.
So basically, like, you show an image of something and then give the word, or like talk through it in the language, or what does that look like?
Well, did you go to the website?
Yes.
And what did you see there?
Let's see. There's a lot of clips.
So you saw results. Mm-hmm. That's one of the differences. Many of the things that are out there on how to save languages rests on theory, and you rarely see results. Mm-hmm. What you see on my website are results. Mm-hmm. And you see that by the third hour of instruction, students already have under their belt over 60, between 60 and 90 phrases that they can say in the language.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
I assume you saw that on the webpage. So one of the things are teaching comments that I have on the webpage.
That's
summaries of what happens from class to class. The classes that I teach only last 2 days out of the week, as opposed to other classes, language classes that go 5 days a week. And I teach roughly 65 minutes each class. So they're getting 2 hours and 10 minutes roughly per week. There's no homework. There's no books. But the key thing is, because I'm working through imagery, by the time we get into the third hour of instruction, I can say something like, Hanen Hanahu Sad Ba Ne Dano Not Haye No Anatithot Hachiswat Deku Thought, and they will know precisely what that is. A man is walking across the road holding a laptop or a computer, talking on a cell phone.
Hmm.
They will know.
Mm-hmm.
Or I could say, they will know precisely what that is. That happens in the third hour of instruction, and that's what you see on that website where you have teaching comments. Mm-hmm. You don't get that with any language teaching method that's out there. It's even faster than immersion, because these things are happening in the third hour of instruction, whereas with immersion, you have to wait 2 to 3 months before children start speaking, because they're absorbing the language and trying to make sense of things because there's no English base. But when you bring in English references rather than base, when you bring in English references, because English is their first language, they divert everything to their strength, the first language, and then they don't pay any attention to the second language.
Okay.
That's why those things don't work when you are translating, because all they hear is their dominant language, their first language, and they don't hear the language that they're trying to learn, the target language. That isn't the case in an immersion setting, but it takes, again, on average 3 months for everything to break through, for children to start making sense of all of the chaos that they hear. That's the other thing. When children learn their first language or even a second language as a child, when they're immersed in it, it's chaotic, but they make sense out of that chaos. And so in the method that I've developed, it has built within it certain elements of chaos. And they have to make sense out of it. But they make sense out of it. The students who are adults make sense out of it very fast. And that's another myth breaker when people think, well, children learn language real easy. They're like sponges. And adults, it's a lot harder for adults. Well, that's not the case. Adults are learning the language through the method that I've developed as fast as children are learning the language. And in fact, maybe faster. And I say cautiously, maybe, but I know that I have to work just as hard, whether they're children or whether they're adults. There's no real difference to get them to settle in to the target language, because it's being delivered through an immersion setting rather than by translating everything. I don't translate things in my classes.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, okay, I'm just curious. I don't know. I'd be curious to hear what you have to say as someone who has really studied this. I'm trying to remember where I heard this, but I heard that with adults, the reason why they learn language is slower, that they're more embarrassed to be corrected, basically, like that they have a harder time, like, making mistakes, essentially,
you know,
than kids do. Is that not true?
Well, those are all excuses. And yes.
Okay.
It's hard to say whether children are less embarrassed or not, because there's always going to be children that are. One of the things that you typically hear when on reservations is that our children are really shy and they don't like to speak and they don't like to be put on the spot. Well, that puts them right in line with adults. These are all myths, or I shouldn't say myths, but there's some kernels of truth to it, but it all rests on their poor methods for teaching a second language, period.
Okay.
If you go back to whatever language you may have studied in high school, unless it was an exceptional teacher, an exceptional program, you learn nothing by the time you finished.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I only because I spent time in Panama in a place where nobody spoke English other than one other person. And then I came back and, like, got stuff out of the class.
Right.
But everyone that didn't have an intensive immersion experience like that didn't get, like you ask them today and they can't say anything.
Exactly. Whereas there's an extremely high retention rate through ASLA. Even after 2 years, there's probably well over 85% retention rate. And then once they're exposed to the language again through ASLA, it fills in almost immediately.
Wow.
You know, here's something that helps with that explanation. When I was at the NALI conference in Hawaii, there was a group that came over from Wisconsin. They were Oneida. And as a child, I had a Mohawk caretaker who would sing Mohawk songs to me. And on the first or second day of the conference, I met some people from the group. And we were talking. They were at a poster session kind of thing. They were at a table. And I told them as a child, I heard all these songs. And they said, well, sing one for us. And I couldn't produce the song. I couldn't remember. But then on the last day, this group decided to do a presentation. And they decided to do a song. And in the song, you have a person who leads the song. And then the group have to do a response. Well, they never practiced. The lead singer started doing the song, and then the group that were in a circle, they were supposed to respond. Nobody responded. And all of a sudden, all the songs flooded back into my head, and I responded.
Huh. Wow. I had a sense you were going to say that. That's awesome.
So let me see. I can't remember if it was a canoe song, but it was the lead would go, yo-ho, hey, yo-ho, hey, oi-ha, oi-ha. So he'd go, oi-ha, and then the response would be, oi-ha, and then and then it would go on and the responses would get a little more complicated. But yeah, I would respond.
Yeah.
And I was shocked that nobody else was responding.
But it triggered something in your brain, though.
Yeah, but it's like that. So the method triggers the brain even when they're 2 years separated from it. The things that were thought to be forgotten flood back in.
Wow. Okay, well, I was so focused on what you were saying that I realized we are actually over our break point. So we are going to take a break. And then I really want to dive back in further on this. So very excited to come back and talk about this more. Okay, well, we only have one more segment and so many more things that I want to ask you. So the first one, I'm curious, you're talking about doing this language program, and obviously you've worked in a lot of different places and with a lot of different languages. So can you tell me a little bit about how you work with the different languages or differences that you've seen in working with different languages?
Well, the method basically works universally with any language, and that was best illustrated when I did the work with the dolphins, because there's no other language learning method that has ever worked with a different species that, like dolphins, and got the dolphin to understand what was being said in the a native language. There's nothing else out there that's done that. But over the years, I have developed a way of doing this. And what I do is, I mentioned earlier, the speed that students learn Arapaho. And Arapaho has a very complicated grammar. But because I film my classes, I actually have time signatures on the film. It shows up on any film or any recording. So I can go back, watch the film, and see what people are learning within what time frame. And in 60 minutes of instruction across 2 days of instruction, because the first 2 days are usually explaining what the student's responsibility is. So when I start, students are literally learning a new concept, word, phrase in the language every 40 seconds of instruction.
Wow.
And then they are tested. And I would test students on the fourth class. Mm-hmm. And they would have to understand 40 different phrases in the language. And they were all getting 100% year after year after year after year. They were not missing a single thing.
Wow.
So over the years, what I started to do is I took that result. Mm-hmm. And I realized at that time, because I was dealing with a lot of first language speakers, that they just didn't understand how you deliver learning a second language in a classroom setting. And so often it was the problem of the students not really wanting to learn or apply themselves. So I would have them learn Arapaho using the method, and so that they would understand what it feels like to be in a situation as a second language learner, because most of them had forgotten what it was like when they were learning English because it was an immersion setting. So they would learn Arapaho, and then they would teach someone. And in the earlier years, it was me, but now I bring students in because there's always these reasons why it was working that people would settle in on. And one, well, you're the professor and you're obviously very good with language and such. And so I would bring students in that were never exposed to the language, and they would then learn the language by people who are teaching, by the teachers. And I did this once in Yellowknife. Well, I've done it all the time, but I was up in Yellowknife, and Margaret Erasmus, her brother was the person who was the head chief, I guess, of Assembly of First Nations. And she invited me up there, and her mother was a first language speaker of Dog Rib. She could never learn the language. It was a 4-day workshop. Roughly, she got 2 hours of instruction over the 4 days. And on the fourth day, I tested her. And I said things that she had never heard in the language. And the group heard that. I would say in Arapaho or something like, Huthet nanahawat wachach ni, ni gahut dasihi nini ahuna. And I'd say, translate that. And she'd look at me like, are you crazy? And I said, just translate it. She said, a horse is running on top of an airplane. And I would give her sentences like that. Like nanahawat hinahinen jibisat das sihid hatetch, stuff like that. And I go, hinahik. So she'd go, Jesus? So what I said to her is, I see a man walking across the ocean, the water, and who is he? And she would go, Jesus? And so people heard that. And they refused to believe. And they said, well, obviously she has a good memory. And she said, no, it's like I can't help myself. And she literally said that. So it shows the effectiveness of the language and how it works. And that's the whole idea, to get people to feel how it works rather than to be lectured at about how it's supposed to work.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. And I have to ask you, I mean, we've talked about this a little bit before, but I want to hear about the dolphin work.
All right. So there's a lot of resistance, and it was like bothering me. And again, what's the key to this? How do I break through? And I was watching, skimming through the channels, and Nova came on with a thing about dolphins. And the scientific community, dolphinists as they're sometimes referred to, for them it's inconclusive whether or not dolphins actually have a language, because there's certain criteria that defines what language is and separates it from communication. And that's where people get confused, because language communicates things and they think communication is language. Well, it's not. There's a difference. And yeah. So I watched this program, and in watching it, Diana Reese was being interviewed, and she's the one who first realized that dolphins recognize themselves in the mirror. And few animals do that. Interestingly, ants do that. They can recognize themselves in a mirror. I'm not sure how that works for an ant, but they've discovered that ants do. I think crows do as well, but chimpanzees and apes, who are supposedly the closest to us, they don't know. They'll try to attack the mirror. So I figured if I can demonstrate that this works across a different species that cannot speak, I'm showing something that has never been shown with any method. So I had to figure out what the problems are. When a student takes a language class, they know they're studying a language. A dolphin has no idea. It's just sounds. It's no different than noise to them. The other thing is I had to get them to understand the testing instrument, which is ASLA. So the first season that I went out, I spent, I think, 16 hours across 3 weeks or 2.5 weeks with a dolphin, trying to understand how the mind of a dolphin works. And I had a brilliant dolphin who was a real deep thinker. And he'd get to a problem, and sometimes he'd sink to the bottom of the lagoon and just sit there like he was thinking through it, and then come up and solve the problem. And then in the second year, I used that information to see if I could push the boundary before I really gave them the true test to figure out whether they understood. But I found out that Kasik had passed on and I couldn't work with him. So I was starting over again and worked with a number of different dolphins, worked through them trying to figure out what was going on. But then I got closer to understanding how the mind of a dolphin works. I also was approaching it from the perspective of dolphins have a culture, and I need to understand that culture to help understand how the mind works. Also, instead of me thinking I was smart enough that I could figure out what dolphins are saying, which is ethnocentric from the scientific community, because that's what they're doing, except now they've shifted to get AI to do it for them, I said, let's see if the dolphin can break my code, meaning break the Arapaho code. So in the third year, 2021, I moved one of the dolphins that I'd worked with the year before. I moved her through a series of figuring problems out, what these sounds meant connected to these images. And then what I did was I realized, in order to conclusively determine whether or not the dolphin actually was hearing the sound, connecting it to the image, as opposed to merely responding to something that's new or responding to something that's moving, I had to isolate all of these different variables. And I figured if I use how dolphin thinks to test, which is creating a pattern, and then break the pattern and give them something that they've never heard before, which is inductive reasoning, I believe, and they figure out the problem, then it means that they conclusively have connected sound to image and have isolated my just moving things and or just introducing something new. So the way the experiment set up, this is actually, no, it's not online. I refuse to put it online because dolphinists will take it and just not understand it. But what I did was I created a sequence of something that the dolphin knew. So if I give you a sequence of 2, 6, 4, 8, what's the next thing that follows that?
Mm-hmm. 10.
Which is?
10.
Right. So it puts the learner in a situation where they're going to second guess what the next thing is in the sequence. But instead of giving them the next thing in the sequence, I gave them something they never heard before. And then the dolphin would have to figure out if they actually are paying attention and they're not responding on movement and or not responding on something that is newly introduced as an image, if they figure the problem out, then that means that they're doing all of that. The connecting sound to image, they're ignoring movement, they're ignoring something that I bring in a new image, and so therefore it's new, they're interested in it, it must be the sound. So I set that up, and I gave them in Arapaho the word for seagull, which they had never heard before, and the dolphin went to the image of a seagull. They did not follow the predicted path that the image of a ball was taking. Mm-hmm. And there was another image that they had only heard once in the process. And so they had to eliminate those sounds, which meant they had to keep it in its bank of sounds and go, this is new thing. This thing that I've just heard is new. I haven't heard it before. It's not the other two things I've been hearing. And the dolphin went to the image of a seagull. And I thought, was this a mistake? And so I had to reset up. I had to get them thinking about something else and doing some other things, and then went back to the sequence again, and the dolphin did it a second time. No other method has ever worked with a dolphin and had that kind of result.
Wow. Have you been back since then? No, I know you were going
to... I haven't been able to get back to the same site. I haven't been able to find... That site was very unique because it was a lagoon, probably man-made, a very large lagoon. Dolphins could swim how and when. And all, there were days when they wouldn't go into the learning. They were separate. They would call them... They weren't calling them little lagoons, but they were separate little learning areas or something. Pool, yeah, P5. So we had P5, which was pool 5. And sometimes the dolphin wouldn't swim into the pool. They just didn't feel like it. And so, you know, they were free to decide what they wanted to do when they wanted to do it. So it made for an interesting situation. But when they got into it, they were very focused. And some of the trainers actually believed that dolphins had names for different trainers. And they certainly were very interested in me. One of the baby dolphins, calves, I'm trying to remember, not Calypso. And it was Calypso. He would follow me along the decks because there was a myriad of decks. And he would follow me. And if I acted like I was ignoring him, he would spit water at me. And then when I turned around, he would turn his back as if, no, that's not me. I didn't do that. And so we'd play like that. And so the dolphins were kind of interested in me and they would play.
And they liked your language game.
Yeah, so like a game, I would sing to them in Arapaho, and they really liked that. And one time, one of the male dolphins, Andros, I had his back to him because the females were in another pool, and he was just in the big, huge open pool. And I heard this snap, snap, and they call it jaw popping. And I went, God, that sounds like somebody's angry. And I turned around, and it was Andros, and he was irritated that I was ignoring him. So I started singing to him, and then he was happy.
Aww. That's awesome.
Yeah. So those are some of the aha, particularly successful creative moments or projects. And it shows two things. One, that language begins first with cognition, being able to understand. And once I laid down that pattern, students were able to produce. I always push the method each year that I teach. So I'm going in this February with a new group, and I'm trying to see how close I can get them to a high level of proficiency, higher than I've ever reached before. So yeah, I'm always pushing it. And again, it shows that it starts with being able to understand. And then because I would push it, 2 years ago, I asked a student, okay, on the third hour of instruction, I said, tell me everything that you actually can say on your own in Arapaho. And I was stunned because the students were able to produce after 2.5 hours, able to produce on their own 16 words and 24 phrases in the language on their own.
Dang. That is impressive.
And those are the kind of results that people then go, well, he must be like cheating or something. Because I film every class, it's there, shown. I mean, you can see it. Well, you don't see it online, but I have all the raw footage and it's there.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. Okay. Well, there is a ton of resources for people that are interested in learning more. You have the Native Strengthening Indigenous Languages and Cultures website on the University of Montana page. So we'll have that in the show notes. There's a ton of, like you said already, class instruction comments on the process for different groups. There's lots of video clips, stories, sample final exam, all sorts of stuff.
If you're interested in seeing my early work with dolphins back in 2018, mm-hmm. that was interviewed by ABC. And if they put in UM Professor Test Dolphins for Language, that should show up.
Okay. And we'll have that in the show notes as well. And also wanted to do a quick shout out. We originally got connected through your Raising Indigenous Voices in Academia and Society conference. So we'll also put a link to the website and YouTube channel for that.
Yes, because on the YouTube channel, they will see the Gumbangir, an Aboriginal group in Australia, who were down to their last speaker, who died in 2019. And now they have brought their language to a point faster than what the Hawaiians have done. When back in 2016, when I started working with them, there was only one adult who had proficiency in the language. And wow. Now they are teaching over 1,000 people from preschool to adults every week.
Wow. Wow.
And there are video clips of what they're doing, and it's amazing.
Wow. Yeah, that's incredible. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thank you so much for the work that you do. For people that are interested, definitely check out those resources in the show notes. And yeah, I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing. It was fascinating. So thank you.
I'm glad you liked it. Hopefully some people will get something out of it.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices' amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.